Chapter 13. Considerations for Commercial Enterprises. The major thrust of this book is do-it-yourself fermentation, and I wholeheartedly encourage anyone with interest to experiment widely. But while I myself have done just that, I have made many ferments just one or two times, many of them not so well, and certainly I am not able to make all of them all the time. This would not be practical, nor is it desirable or necessary. Whether in the realm of informal gift exchange and barter economies, or in commercial production, some can produce beer, others bread, kraut, tempeh, kombucha, etc., neither individuals nor households need or can be self-sufficient. Exchange can broaden everybody's possibilities. Historically, fermentation has spawned such specialization, and through that process, refinements of technique. People devote their careers and lives to each realm of fermentation that I have covered in a chapter. Though all ferments are simple enough at their core, techniques can be elaborated with great nuance. Ferments are among the original value-added products, in which the raw outputs of agriculture are transformed, via great technique and artistry, into delicacies that are stable and can be transported, and that fill our kitchens and food stores. The revival of fermentation at the local and regional scale goes hand in hand with the revival of local agriculture in the movement toward relocalization of our food and our economics. Fermentation enterprises offer great possibilities for people who acquire the skills of fermentation to put them to use as means of economic support. This is economic development based on real production, real value, and real benefit, creating better choices for our communities by expanding the range of what is available as local food. We can revive local commercial production of ferments, as the revival of microbreweries, farmstead cheese production, and artisan bakeries demonstrate. And we do not need to wait for other people to do it. No less so than home fermentation, reviving fermentation in the form of local enterprise is a do-it-yourself venture. In this chapter, I have collected stories and lessons conveyed to me by people who have started small fermentation enterprises. Through the work that I have been doing spreading information about fermentation, I have met many people who have started fermentation enterprises ranging from informal, unlicensed underground producers to well-established businesses with sales totaling millions of dollars a year. Let me clearly state that I have never run a food manufacturing business at any scale. For me, food has been a realm of pleasure, exploration, creation, sharing, and sometimes even crusading. Ongoing commercial-scale food production has never been part of my life. Production can, but doesn't have to, be the death of pleasure. And the bottom line can, but doesn't have to, conflict with ideals. Balancing a for-profit business with working with food as my activism has certainly been the biggest challenge, reflects Sash Sunday of Ole Kraut in Olympia, Washington. There is a certain amount of capitalism required for a sustainable business within this society, and it is difficult sometimes to know what the best decision is. There are many models of production, some of which are highlighted here. The same ingenuity and creativity that people bring to fermentation itself, they can bring to their efforts to use fermentation skills as a source of livelihood. Consistency. Consistency is not necessarily important to the home experimentalist. Personally, I'm quite content for every batch of miso or kraut to be different, and that has been the source of much discovery in my experiential education. And some rare producers successfully market the utter uniqueness of each batch. For example, Enlightenment Wines in New York State, which produces and markets quirky, single-batch concoctions. However, commercial production typically requires a certain level of consistency. This can be a challenge given the vicissitudes of microbial life. The bacteria and fungi we count on exist in a much broader context. They are sensitive to temperature and humidity, and other differences in environment or nutrients. Their growth continually alters their population densities and creates metabolic byproducts that alter their environments, giving rise to community succession. Fermentations tend to vary. I try to educate my customers on that as much as possible, says April McGregor of Farmer's Daughter brand in Carrboro, North Carolina. And because I am almost completely direct sale, I can do that. I also prefer to offer tastes of new batches so people know what they are getting. Nathan and Emily Pujol, who propagate and sell cultures as Yimus in Michigan, report that generally the ferments became more consistent because we had to be more disciplined in our timing to avoid wasting ingredients and time. Nonetheless, the ferment inevitably shifts. Cultures will go through different stages throughout the seasons. We continually adjust to get a good schedule, and we are constantly finding ourselves catering to our cultures at odd hours until we make the right adjustments. Propagating cultures, more than any other fermentation practice, requires continuous attention and would be impossible for someone who constantly enjoys being out or vacationing. The changing of the seasons can have many implications for a fermentation enterprise. Not only do temperatures fluctuate, speeding or slowing fermentation and potentially encouraging different organisms or enzyme activity, but the availability of critical ingredients shifts as well. Kathy Smith of Oregon pondered these questions in an email as she considered starting a business fermenting vegetables. "I don't know how to structure a business plan based on seasonal ingredients," she wrote. "Do I make enough of my amazing pickles to last through the year? If so, how do I refrigerate them properly? Do I run out of the cucumber pickles naturally and replace them with pickled beets in winter?" These seem to appeal to different markets. This is a huge issue for any business fermenting local vegetables. We really like the quality of early season cabbages, which we harvest June to November, says krautmaker Marco Colby of Midori Farm in Port Townsend, Washington. The storage cabbages tend to be a little tougher and stronger in taste. We are still figuring out how to keep the product fully locally grown while meeting the demand all year long. Most producers of vegetable ferments, who are committed to using locally grown produce, ferment vegetables in their seasons, then rely on cool storage of the ferments to preserve them through the year. Shifting temperatures through the year also impact fermentation. Some enterprises avoid fermenting in the heat of summer. I scale back a bit on fermentation in the summer because the heat makes it harder to control yeast as well as mold, says April McGregor. Because summer is such a busy time for making fruit preserves, it works out for me, but I'm not sure it would work out if I did strictly fermented products. Diversification can be a source of strength. Other enterprises adapt to the seasonal highs and lows. Luckily, most seasonal variation happens gradually, observes Aaron Bullock, who bakes and ferments vegetables with the Small World Collective in Rochester, New York. As winter approaches, the loaves take a little longer to rise. We notice this and move the bulk fermentation to a warmer corner of the kitchen, turn up the proofer, increase the amount of starter, etc. More dramatic changes happen when we switch to a different crop of wheat. Depending on the weather that year, the variety, the soil, the planting and harvest schedule, there will be big differences between them. This just takes some getting used to. Hopefully those practice batches weren't too big or needed to fulfill an order. In their home-based culture propagating operation, Nathan and Emily Pujol locate shelves and cupboards in strategic spots all over the house to avoid direct sunlight or extreme hot or cold spots throughout the seasons. When the seasons change, we have to rearrange our house to keep it optimal. Some geographic locations have more temperature stability than others. Marco Colby of Midori Farm in Port Townsend writes, "We are fortunate that the air temperature here is regulated by the Puget Sound and Strait of San Juan, so it is really ideal most of the year for uncontrolled temperature fermentation, which really helps with producing a consistent product." In contrast, Catherine Lucas, a fermented vegetable producer located in Santa Cruz, California, reports that she was forced to install an air conditioner in her kraut aging room to keep temperatures at 64 degrees Fahrenheit or 18 degrees Celsius after two barrels of kraut went soft in a summer heat wave. "Consistent temperatures seem to be exceptionally important in larger scale production," concludes Catherine. A couple of producers offered other suggestions for achieving consistent fermentation results. "Record everything," exhorts Aaron Bullock, "because sometimes it takes a while to gauge the significance of a small change in recipe, process, or conditions." Simon Gorman of Caldwell Biofermentation, Canada, in St. Edwidge, Quebec, counsels a scientific approach. "Be sure you have adequate scientific backup so that you know what is in your fermentations, in order to standardize your product, and so that you can deal with the inevitable issues that arise when you are dealing with the complexity of a living process," he advises. Caldwell Biofermentation, which started out producing fermented vegetables, collaborated with an Agriculture Canada research station to develop a starter culture for vegetables, which it now produces and sells. Consistency does not mean that there is no room for experimentation. A number of producers make a few primary products that are distributed widely, along with smaller batches of more experimental variations with more limited appeal. Looking at our front fridge, we currently have 10 krauts, 8 kombuchas, 15 seasonal specialty pickles, and 3 types of traditional Japanese pickles, nukazuke, kasazuke, misozuke, reports Alex Husvin of Cultured Pickle Shop in Berkeley, California. The krauts are the only product we produce in volume, and those are distributed around Northern California. Everything else we retail here, at their production facility, and at farmers' markets. For Cultured Pickle Shop and most other commercial manufacturers at any scale, no matter how fun and rewarding the more experimental variations are, it is the most familiar products that make up the core of the business. We've done a pinto bean and black bean tempeh, reports Gainesville, Florida tempeh maker Art Guy. Both did really well in the market. We are more just trying to get this food on the mainstream restaurants' menus rather than create oddball tempehs. First steps. So, you like the idea of turning your passion for fermentation into a small business. Where do you start? Get really good at what you do first, advises Marco Colby. Start small and focus on quality. Nathan and Emily Pujol recommend practicing your ferment through a full calendar year before going into business. At least go through the heat of the summer and the cold of winter before trying to get into a fermenting venture. At a small scale, it is possible to operate by word of mouth, under the radar of regulatory agencies, but in order to establish a legitimate food production business, you must gain the approval of regulators. Figure out the regulations for your area first, advises April McGregor. Every state, and sometimes county, is different. In many places, extension services, regulatory agencies, or educational institutions offer classes to help potential applicants understand licensing and certification requirements. Mark Olenek of Lidditz Pickle Company in Pennsylvania suggests, find the closest college/university that has a food science program. Each of these schools usually has an industry-related extension program that is usually funded by grants to help support startup businesses. One way to minimize both startup expenses and regulatory scrutiny is to start in a shared kitchen facility. We spent about a year researching necessary information on how to start a small-scale food production business, explains Jennifer DeMarco of Fab Ferments in Cincinnati, Ohio. We made the decision to launch our business in a shared-use incubator kitchen. This was a great decision for us because the burden of maintaining and building our own kitchen was lifted. Incubator kitchens, some with extensive small business development support, exist in more and more places. If your business stays small, you can maintain it there without any big capital investment. If it flops, there are no huge losses, and if your business takes off, you may outgrow the shared facility. After 7 years of working out of a community kitchen, we finally purchased our own building last year and turned it into our very own pickle factory, which has been working out very well, reports Dan Rosenberg of Real Pickles in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Most of the fermentation entrepreneurs I have talked with counsel a modest startup. I would suggest starting small and growing organically, meaning keep your day job at first, says April McGregor, who runs her business out of her home, which is possible in some places and not in others. Figure out where you will source your produce. Know your market/competition, prices, demand, etc. I am a huge proponent of direct sale, and farmers markets have been a great place to start and grow my business. Starting small gives a new enterprise the chance to discover, before making a huge investment, whether it can sell the products that it wants to make, and whether it can make any money doing so, the ultimate questions upon which the viability of any business plan hinges, no matter what the scale of ambition. Like any other business, a new venture must meet an unfilled need or create demand from a newly innovated product, observes Dave Arith of Alexander Valley Gourmet, a pickle and sauerkraut maker in Healdsburg, California. New ventures based on fermentation should bring something exciting and new to the market. In many places, including the rural area where I live, locally grown and fermented foods are simply not commercially available, and so the market, such as it is completely unserved. But how big is the market? How do you reach it, or how do you help it emerge? Brian Geyer, who grows vegetables and ferments them under the label Sour Power in Frankfort, Kentucky, says the krauts speak for themselves, and people want them, so we have our work cut out for us just trying to supply the small cities around us. I have a feeling that a lot of little fermentation businesses are going to sprout in the next little while. In other places, such as, for example, the San Francisco Bay Area or the Pioneer Valley of Western Massachusetts, there are many different types of commercial fermentation happening locally, with a multitude of available options. Those of us who arrived early to this party were able to take advantage of the total absence from the grocer's shelves of basic live culture fermented products, reflects Dave Erith. Like most markets, however, the fermented food market is becoming more competitive. Yet there can also be a synergetic momentum when many different types of fermented products reinforce and complement one another. Will Savitri of Catalyst Kombucha and Green River Ambrosia Meadery in Greenfield, Massachusetts writes, "I would like to convey to you what I feel is a very unique situation in our region of Western Massachusetts. I believe that we probably have a greater concentration of small/medium-scale businesses that are based in natural fermentation than anywhere else in the country." In addition to his two ventures, within 20 miles are South River Miso Company, Real Pickles, several breweries, wineries, and bakeries, as well as West County Cider, Caveman Foods, Waterkeeper Sodas, and Valley Malt, one of the nation's few small-scale malters. Some talented and lucky producers hit the right market with the right product at the right time. Catherine Lucas of Farmhouse Culture, a Santa Cruz, California krautmaker who first went commercial just 3 years ago, reports, "We currently sell about 8,000 pounds a month, and that number is growing steadily." Californians were really ready for fresh krauts. Nathan Schomber of Bucci, an Asheville, North Carolina kombucha maker, says, "We can't keep up with the demand." And when Raphael Lyons of Enlightenment Wines in the Hudson Valley near New York City announced the debut of his community-supported alcohol model, I received an avalanche of interest. The blogosphere erupted, and next thing I knew, I sold out the CSA membership over the course of a few days. Despite the many success stories, success can never be guaranteed. "Expect to make no money and work every day all day, literally," states Luke Rigobuto. "Do not expect to make money for years." Brian Mose, founder of the year-old Viable Cultures in Asheville, North Carolina, is slightly more upbeat. "Profitability and financial success is still questionable, in my experience, but it seems very possible." Dan Rosenberg, more than a decade and a new building into his pickle-making enterprise, cautions, "There remain significant limitations to the markets for these foods. Natural foods and farm-oriented markets are great venues, but it is important to be realistic about the challenges in trying to sell to more conventional markets. Wherever one is selling one's fermented products, it is important to strive for as much product consistency as possible and to be prepared to devote resources to educating one's potential customer base about the unconventional characteristics of the products." The necessity of educating customers is repeated by many fermentation practitioners. "Make sure folks who buy your products know that you have to keep it refrigerated because it's not a pasteurized, shelf-stable product," says Aaron Bullock. "Our advice for someone starting up a fermenting venture would be to make sure that understanding and education go along with selling," offer Nathan and Emily Pujol. Scaling up. There is much to be learned scaling up from a home fermentation practice to commercial production. We found that non-brined vegetable pickles, sauerkraut, shredded carrots, etc., scaled up with no problem, recounts Dan Rosenberg. But we found that brined products, particularly cucumber pickles, were exceedingly difficult to scale up with regard to salt concentration. "We never found a successful formula to guide us in choosing salt quantities as we scaled up our dill pickles recipe from quart size to 15 gallons, then 30 gallons, then finally 55 gallons. We found the optimal salt concentration only by trial and error. For our sauerkrauts, we actually found that our quality and consistency improved as we scaled up. It may be that a more vigorous fermentation is achieved with a bigger mass of vegetables, and therefore a bigger population of lactobacilli. Or it may be due to a more successful airlock overall." Allison Ewald of Northeast Missouri bakes 18 loaves of bread once a week for informal distribution within a close-knit community on a donation and barter basis. Even at her small scale, she encountered huge hurdles scaling up. I learned about temperature, humidity, the baker's percentage, and many other things I had never considered much in my home baking. I learned that my personal connection to the dough and the bread and the fire was the most important element, that I need to stay in constant connection and keep observing and learning. For Brian Mose, the challenges of scaling up pertained mostly to the equipment, infrastructure, and technique. But after experimenting with different setups at different home locations, this was just another adaptive challenge. There were so many little details. Not having a commercial fermented food mentor, I put to work my own creativity in making the transition points, or else the creativity of other friends and business associates. One of the biggest issues in scaling up is figuring out and securing appropriate vessels that are safe, legal, effective, durable, and affordable. Many small operations use ceramic crocks, even though they are expensive, fragile, and heavy. Cultured Pickle Shop in Berkeley uses stainless steel vats, designed for the winemaking industry, with adjustable tops that can press down to the surface and vacuum seal the contents. Be sure not to use stainless vessels that are not specifically designed to withstand acidification. In a pinch, we tried using large stainless steel brew pots, recounts Luke Regalbuto. We found out the hard way that this can be disastrous. Often cheap stainless steel pots have handles that are fastened to the pot with aluminum. We had to throw away a large batch of product when we found that it had completely eroded the aluminum fastenings. We have also had problems with the cheap pots losing a sort of painted-on stainless steel finish. For the most part, health inspectors do not accept the use of wooden barrels. Finding the right vessel has been super challenging, according to Catherine Lucas. Wood barrels are out of the question, according to the health department. Ceramic too heavy and expensive, and stainless steel too expensive and very hard on the earth in terms of metal extraction. We ferment in the blue plastic food-safe 57-gallon barrels. It was a really hard decision. We've gone out of our way to not use plastic of any sort in our packaging. Our krauts are sold in reusable ceramic crocks at the retail level and compostable deli containers at farmers markets. Several experts have confirmed that our barrels are safe and that there is no transference, but I would prefer to use wood. I'm hoping that the bioplastics industry will soon provide an alternative. Some producers have found it difficult to find food-grade weights to press down on their ferments. We are currently working with a production glass manufacturer to try out using custom-made food-grade glass discs to weigh down pickles into brine, explains Dan Rosenberg. We have never been able to come up with any other appropriate options for food-grade weights. Beyond vessels, the right tools can help with scaling up. Food processors are your friends, says Aaron Bullock. Marco Colby describes the continuous feed Robot Coop commercial shredder that Midori Farm invested in, affectionately known on their farm as the Super Shredder, as amazing. We could shred 40 pounds of cabbage in 8 minutes and control the size of shred for different products. After shredding, Aaron Bullock and her fellow collective members use a 140-quart spiral mixer to mix and pound the kraut. This works so well that after 20 minutes of mixing, lots of juice is expelled from the cabbage. We don't have to pound the kraut by hand at all. We run the mixer when it is 1/4 full for 3 to 5 minutes to compact the cabbage that's in there and make room for more. Brian Mose recommends getting a pH meter and learning how to calibrate and use it correctly to monitor pH levels of your fermenting products. But don't rush out to buy a lot of expensive equipment before you start. Start small and simple, and only upgrade your equipment as your demand increases, offers Tressa Jellig of Salt, Fire, and Time in Portland, Oregon. The Tempeh Shop, Gainesville, Florida. One fermentation enterprise I have visited in my travels really stands out in illustrating how the myriad small technical challenges of fermentation can be overcome with good systems developed over time through creative problem solving. Jose Caraballo started making tempeh commercially in 1985. Today he operates his business, the Tempeh Shop, with his son and daughter. They sell tempeh to restaurants, at the farmers market, and via local retail grocers. When I toured their factory, I was impressed by Jose's clever adaptations of readily available technology. To dry the beans, one of the most laborious parts of the process, he created a simple device in which to place the drained pot of beans. The pot sits at an angle and rotates, so the beans continually get turned over as a fan blows air right onto them. They make the tempeh in plastic bags with holes poked in them. You can do this by hand with a pin or a fork if you are doing just a few, but hundreds? Jose created an ingenious roller with nails poking out to be a hole puncher. Jose and his family fill each bag with cooled, dried soybeans that have been inoculated with spores. Bags are flattened into 1-inch or 2.5-centimeter slabs and placed on open shelves on a rack on rollers. The rack is then taken to the incubation room, where a space heater and an air conditioner, both tied to thermostats, together function to keep the developing tempeh in the desired 85 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 29 to 32 degrees Celsius temperature range. It took Jose decades to refine his systems, but in doing so, he exemplifies an indomitable human spirit of inventiveness. You can too. Another consideration for any food business is packaging. Many health and eco-conscious consumers would prefer to purchase food packaged in glass jars than in plastic tubs, although of course this drives prices higher. Some enterprises collect deposits on reusable vessels to encourage customers to return them for reuse. Some eco-friendly businesses are turning to corn-derived plastics for containers. For operations that ship food or cultures, there are more packaging decisions to make. Nathan and Emily Pujol ship cultures all across the United States. It is a challenge to keep the cultures in their most fresh and vibrant state since they will not be under the same conditions as they're used to. And it results in us constantly testing and tweaking our methods each season. We must also be aware of where they are shipping to, how long it will take, and the general temperature along the way. Codes, regulations, and licensing. One of the biggest challenges in moving from fermentation for personal use to commercial production is the complex regulatory framework in which commercial food enterprises operate. Some people with small operations manage to avoid this by operating outside of this legal framework, under the radar of enforcement. This is the situation for Allison Ewald, baking 18 loaves of bread each week in her earth oven. "I am a speck that doesn't register on any radar," she says. Jean Kowacki is a single mom in Florida who sells about 100 bottles of kombucha each week, along with fermented vegetables, no two batches alike, to other parents at her kids' school and people she has met through her local health food store and local nutritional advocacy groups, all through word of mouth. "I am trying to stay out of the commercial eye for now, for it would be expensive for me to legitimize my business," she says. The amount of bureaucracy and overhead associated with a legitimate food business is overwhelming and debilitating, report Luke Regalbuto and Maggie Levenger of Wild West Ferments. Michael Thompson of the Chicago Honey Cooperative minces no words. "Fly under the radar as long as possible." For a small enough venture, informal and under the radar can be perfect, especially given ever-growing registration and reporting requirements on food production businesses from agencies at every level of government. But there are severe limitations to an under-the-radar enterprise. It is hard to develop your business if you can't freely promote it. All over the world, people are managing to ferment foods and beverages at all different scales, successfully negotiating the terms of established regulatory frameworks. These frameworks are evolving, and in general, they seem more appropriately suited to large operations than small ones. The 2011 Food Safety Modernization Act gave the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, a legislative mandate to require comprehensive, science-based preventive controls across the food supply. All but the very smallest food manufacturers must develop and implement a Hazard Analysis and Critical Control Point Plan, better known as an HACCP plan. According to the FDA, HACCP is a systematic approach to the identification, evaluation, and control of food safety hazards based on the following 7 principles. Principle 1. Conduct a hazard analysis. Principle 2. Determine the critical control points, CCPs. Principle 3. Establish critical limits. Principle 4. Establish monitoring procedures. Principle 5. Establish corrective actions. Principle 6. Establish verification procedures. Principle 7. Establish record-keeping and documentation procedures. This is a fine methodology for a large or possibly even mid-size organization to use. But for small individual, partnership, family, one or two part-time employee-type enterprises, being forced to formalize so much can amount to an onerous requirement, taking time and resources that are not feasible at that scale of production. The looming specter of HACCP drove Pascal and Eric, California goat farming and cheese-making partners I visited a few years ago, to abandon their dream. It would take us between 25 and 30 hours a week to perform and document all the testing that would be required, explains Pascal. For us, that would mean a part-time employee for whom we'll need an ADA-compliant bathroom, a changing room, and a break room, plus a fully equipped laboratory. Between salary, workers' comp, testing in-house, and microbiological testing by a contract lab, we'll need to budget $50,000 per year. We produce 5,000 pounds of cheese per year. This is why I think that to stay in business, a cheesemaker must produce at least 50,000 to 100,000 pounds per year. The 2011 Food Safety Law specifically exempted from HACCP requirements operations with gross sales below $500,000, and mostly direct sales. But some areas, notably meat and milk, face special scrutiny. The FDA has repeatedly reviewed its policy on raw milk cheeses, which allows cheeses from raw milk so long as they have been aged more than 60 days, a reasonable, if somewhat arbitrary, standard that has been in place since the 1940s. Many producers and aficionados fear that raw milk cheeses may be banned altogether. An FDA review a decade ago was shelved after it caused a wave of concern over imported raw milk cheeses that many cheese fanciers feared would be banned, according to the New York Times. Today, with the artisan cheese industry booming, the focus is on homegrown cheesemakers. The American Raw Milk Cheese Presidium is a collaboration between Slow Food and members of the Raw Milk Cheesemakers Association. To be part of the Presidium, members must adhere to strict voluntary requirements, including HACCP plans and bacterial testing to standards far stricter than the FDA's. Many larger operations welcome clear science-based regulations. For some smaller operations, it may be impossible or burdensome, though others with deeper pockets persevere. I am not suggesting that healthy animals, hygienic practices, and food safety are any less important for a small-scale dairy than for a large-scale one. But the same limited scale that makes the requirements burdensome for small farmstead operators also limits the potential for and scale of danger. It is not desirable to make small farmstead production impractical. Farmstead Creamery Challenges. Nathan Arnold simultaneously started up a dairy farm and a cheese-making operation at Sequatchie Cove Creamery in Sequatchie, Tennessee. He was mortified when the very first cheese sample he sent to the State Department of Agriculture tested positive for Listeria monocytogenes, and subsequent batches tested positive for Staphylococcus aureus. Levels were not so high that the state prohibited their sale as cheese, and no bacterially produced enterotoxins were found. Whether to sell or discard the cheese was a management decision, he was told. Nathan chose to play it safe and discarded them. In the end, the farm culled its herd of the cows that tested positive for S. aureus, because as a certified organic farm, they cannot treat animals with antibiotics. Nathan's advice to fledgling farmstead cheesemakers is to test cows for S. aureus. Test each teat when you get the cows and every month thereafter. Also test every batch of cheese at 3 days and at maturity for both S. aureus and L. monocytogenes. Test a sample from the bulk tank monthly. With culling and frequent testing, Nathan was able to solve the creamery's contamination problems with the help of a French cheesemaking technical consultant and a voluntary HACCP plan, which he regards as a proactive stance that demonstrates responsibility. Now that Nathan and his team have the cheesemaking down, they are finding it difficult to sell all the cheese they are making, so they must increase their cave conditions storage capacity and further develop their marketing. The learning curve is huge, he reflects. The dairy has spent many thousands of dollars on bacteriological testing and now routinely spends more than 4% of its gross income on testing. Nathan takes the long view. One season into year two, he points toward year five as his goal for achieving consistency, marketing success, and profitability. People's experiences of code enforcement vary widely. It didn't seem to make any difference what product we were making, the requirements were the same regardless, explains Aaron Bullock. Actually, it was easier to get our products licensed because they are fermented and live, not canned, insists Marco Colby. The doors were slammed in my face repeatedly, and I was discouraged all the way, reports Patricia Grignau, who sought to produce kombucha commercially in Virginia. Sometimes it seems the entire industry/government is against your business, reflects Florida tempeh maker Art Guy. some fledgling businesses encounter outright hostility from enforcement agencies. We had an unsettling event recently, reports Luke Rigobuto of Wild West Ferment in Marin County, California. I had a man in plain clothing flash a police badge and pull me aside for questioning. Right away, he started out with threats and intimidation tactics that he cleverly combined with offers of help from the trouble I might be facing. He said things like, "I know where you live, don't make me get a warrant," and "There are several enforcement departments that don't like what you guys are doing and want to shut you down." When I tried to find out what exactly the problem was, he was very vague. "It sounds like there was some sort of complaint slash concern, and there are fears that our products might contain botulism." Therefore, he wanted me to meet him first thing after the weekend to collect some samples of our product so he can drive them directly to a lab several hours away for testing. When I responded to his concern of botulism by informing him that our product is fermented, he gave me a blank stare. I met with him the following morning despite my suspicion that he might not be the special investigator that he claimed to be. After I gave him the samples, I again explained that our products are live fermented foods that are not canned and should be kept refrigerated. A light went off this time, and after calling his boss, they decided it was indeed a misunderstanding and called off the investigation. The event did sound alarms, and so the county health department has proceeded to take particular interest in our obscure food processing. They now consistently go out of their way to give us an especially hard time. He offers this general advice. Generally, it is best to have as little communication with the health department as possible. Many people seeking to license fermentation businesses encounter officials with little knowledge or understanding of the fermentation process. Many in the regulatory agencies are not so familiar with this type of food manufacturing, observes Brian Mose. Same goes with insurance companies. April McGregor found that the lack of clearly defined rules is maddening. She recalls, "The North Carolina Department of Agriculture did not know what to do with me." The county office had never had to deal with fermented foods before, so they were learning as they went with me. I went ahead and got my licensing to sell acidified foods, but it turned out that I didn't technically need it to sell fermented foods since they fall under the naturally acidified classification. In the end, they decided that I should buy a pH meter and test the pH of each batch of product that I sell and record that in a ledger. Others have had similar experiences, educating regulators and finding ways to document the quality and safety of each batch. We have generally found that the local, state, and federal regulators we interact with have little prior knowledge of lactic acid fermentation, reports a producer who asked not to be identified. But we learned early on that this challenge can generally be overcome by communicating what we know about the process in a confident tone that makes the regulators trust that we know what we are doing. Our regulators have required us to document pH of each batch, but have not subjected us to any strict regimens, like HACCP, FDA, acidified food rules, etc. The burden may be on you to present documentation of the safety of the ferments you wish to produce. Have a list of commercially available and well-known products to compare your product with, advises Luke Rigobuto. Some producers enlisted the support of research experts. The state of California was very concerned about my low-salt krauts, which of course are not low-salt at all, 1.5%, explains Catherine Lucas. So they asked me to run my recipes by a microbiologist at UC Davis, who in turn introduced me to Dr. Fred Bright, a microbiologist who is also a kraut expert, North Carolina State University. Dr. Bright has become a trusted ally and gives me advice when I push the limits of lacto-fermentation with my sometimes strange recipes. Other than that, the public officials have been pretty cool, especially after Dr. Bright told them that there has never been a case of food poisoning involving sauerkraut, and that lacto-fermentation is considered one of the safest food preservation methods. It is usually easy to document the effectiveness and safety of fermentation, because historical and biological facts back it up. Do the research and present the facts. Maybe you'll have an experience like Jennifer DeMarco. "We feel like our inspector's main goal is to help us succeed by producing the safest food possible for others to enjoy. This is how it should be." We feel like they actually enjoy learning about fermentation and even recall stories of making kraut back in the day with their family. There are many more specialized regulations covering alcoholic beverages, milk and meat products, and organic certification. The manufacture of alcoholic beverages, along with ethanol biofuels, is strictly controlled, regulated, and taxed in the United States by several different agencies, including the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, ATF, and the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau, TTB, both in the Treasury Department as well as analogous state agencies. The government definitely wants its piece of the action. Among the interests of these agencies is exactly who owns and controls the production of alcohol. Raphael Lyons promoted his Enlightenment Wines enterprise as community-supported alcohol and offered subscriptions as shares in the winery. After his unusual business model was written up in some popular blogs, he received a stern message from the New York State Liquor Authority about the limits of my license. He was told that owning shares of my winery with a dividend of 3 mixed cases a year is a big no-go. You can't own any part of a winery without being on the license. Several fermentation entrepreneurs mentioned that the biggest regulatory challenge was organic certification. For a processed food to be certified organic, it takes an amazing amount of tracking paperwork, says Marco Colby. You would think it would be easy because most of our ingredients are coming from the farm, but we need to generate invoices for each ingredient we transfer from the farm to the processing kitchen. Beyond the ingredients themselves, processing equipment must all be certified organic. So, if a small producer of, say, apple cider, brings organic apples to a larger facility for pressing, the cider cannot be labeled as organic unless that facility is certified as organic, which is typically not the case. Different business models, farm-based operations, diversification, and specialization. People start fermentation businesses with a wide range of different visions. Some want a small, personal enterprise that will provide them with some income but have no grander ambitions. Some are thrilled at the prospect of growth. Some enterprises start on farms as a complement to farming, adding value to the farm's raw agricultural products. Some businesses develop in ways that fill very specific niches. Some incorporate fermentation into broader food businesses, such as restaurants or caterers. There is no single business model for fermentation enterprises. Many realms of fermentation have historically occurred on farms. Winemaking has also been an extension of grape growing, or maybe vice versa, as cheesemaking has always gone hand in hand with keeping and milking animals. In our post-agrarian and post-industrial age, of course, wine and cheese, like any other foods, get mass-produced far from the farm. But with both these products, as well as apple cider, fermented vegetables, and probably other types of ferments, many small revivalist producers are doing so right on their farms. Mark Shepard and his family in Viola, Wisconsin, have an unconventional farm, using permaculture ideas and diverse forest crops, with a focus on hazelnuts, chestnuts, and apples. Prime apples they can sell, but the ones that fall to the ground or are badly blemished, they ferment into cider. After 4 years, we're finally legal to sell our value-added farm product, hard cider, announced Mark in 2010. Flack Family Farm in Vermont is a diversified farm offering vegetables, milk, and meat. Every fall, the Flacks host a series of work days, inviting friends and neighbors to come join them in cleaning and shredding vegetables and pounding them into barrels. Everyone takes home a bucket of shredded veggies to ferment at home, and the Flacks get help transforming their fields of vegetables into a stable product that they can sell for the rest of the year. Nancy and Pat Curley of Traverse City, Michigan, practice what they have termed farm-intation, from seed to plant to harvest to finished fermented product right here on our own farm. Grow your own produce, exclaims Marco Colby, whose Midori farm grows all the veggies they ferment, except for ginger and other spices. Fresh produce makes a superior ferment every time. My friend Brian Geyer, who grows and ferments vegetables under the brand name Sour Power in Frankfort, Kentucky, envisions expanding his enterprise into a larger farmer-producer cooperative. My dream is to grow this business to a point where it can process and sell more than we can grow, and bring on other organic farmers as owners and producers. That would outgrow the kitchen we currently use, a shared incubator kitchen, and to build a completely off-grid commercial kitchen with a root cellar for storage of fermenting vessels and finished jars. I really think it is possible, even with regs, although it will take a lot of work to get there. Good work. Like most entrepreneurs who start small businesses, Brian has an expansive vision. Some fermentation businesses do take off and grow fast. Our company began about 5 years ago as a one-man garage operation, reports Dave Arith of Alexander Valley Gourmet in Healdsburg, California. We now have a couple of employees and will probably double our production this year. Catherine Lucas's farmhouse culture has grown in just 2 years to selling at 9 farmers markets and 58 retail locations in Northern California, as she explores markets in Southern California. Rather than national distribution of her products, Lucas's vision for growth is to expand by building fermentoriums in various locations, developing recipes with ingredients that are locally abundant, and selling those krauts just in those regions. Not every fermentation entrepreneur is eager for their business to grow. "My business is still very small, and I wrestle every day with how and whether or not I should grow it," reflects April McGregor. "Keeping it as small as it is means that I personally make and test every batch of product that leaves my kitchen. This is how I maintain consistency at present. Currently, I am bursting at the seams in my kitchen, so scaling up would mean finding a new location and new licensing, likely no longer the Department of Agriculture, but Health Department instead." Some small fermentation entrepreneurs are emphatic that they do not wish to grow. "Staying small is more than a technical or business decision," declares Raphael Lyons. "For me, it's what allows me to be revolutionary in a permanent state of radical experimentation." Often, businesses go to the opposite extreme. Rather than functioning in a permanent state of experimentation, they find a specialized niche and fill it. One interesting niche serving the DIY fermentation movement is propagating and selling fermentation cultures. For at least one culture producer, the fact that what they are selling is not itself a food has meant that they have avoided dealing with regulators. "We haven't pursued licensing because it's not technically a food product." One fermentation business I know, the Ceres Community Project in Sebastopol, California, grew out of a nonprofit agency operating through an integrated model that gives teens experiences of growing and preparing healthy food, provides those facing cancer and other life-threatening illnesses with nourishing meals, and educates the larger community about the connection between food, healing, and wellness. The sauerkraut business is an offshoot of these broader objectives. One of the foods their teen workers were preparing for the cancer patients was sauerkraut. In response to the popularity of their sauerkraut, they started packaging it and selling it through local retailers, including Whole Foods. Now, sauerkraut sales are helping to support the organization's service activities. Another model for people who enjoy variety is the Community-Supported Kitchen, CSK, inspired by Community-Supported Agriculture, CSA. But instead of raw vegetables, it provides prepared foods, including a rotating selection of ferments. This business model was pioneered by Three Stone Hearth in Berkeley, California, but it is rapidly spreading. A related idea is a more traditional prepared meal catering service. My friend Lagusta Yearwood has a vegan meal service in New Paltz, New York, for which she makes her own tempeh, krauts, miso, and vinegar. Many restaurants have also incorporated ferments they make themselves into their menus. This is but a cursory overview of ways in which people have transformed their passion for fermentation into their livelihood. My advice to anyone wishing to embark upon a fermentation-based enterprise is to learn as much as you can about how other people have set up such businesses. If you can, try to apprentice yourself with an experienced artisan producer whose products you admire. Reach out to other producers, just to talk to them, visit their operations, and have them to use as resources as you chart your own path. If local enterprises are reluctant to share information because they perceive you as a competitor, try reaching out to people farther away. Many people love to share their techniques and systems if someone seems genuinely interested. Above all, I want to offer encouragement to fermentation lovers trying to figure out ways to support themselves. Fermentation may offer a viable and honorable path. The relocalization of our food demands that we create and support, beyond local agriculture, an array of local processors, fermenters, prime among them.